Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us wherever you're listening via the KPECC app, kpecc.org, where we stream 24/7 or through our terrestrial radio broadcast 89.3 and all our transmitters from Santa Barbara to the Coachella Valley. Later this hour on Air Talk, we'll take a look at the LA Unified School District's future of on-campus instruction. A group of parents have filed a lawsuit against the district, saying their kids are getting a substandard distance education in the district. That follows a state lawsuit that's been filed up in the San Francisco Bay Area as well. So we have multiple parents groups who are taking that action. But we begin today with the latest on COVID-19. Very pleased to have with us from Pasadena's Huntington Hospital infectious disease specialist, Dr. Kimberly Schreiner. Good morning, Dr. Schreiner.
Good morning, Larry.
Want to start first close to home for you. How's the staff at Huntington dealing with the ongoing nature of this and all the stress surrounding caring for COVID patients?
Well, like all hospitals, we are certainly experiencing a pretty scary uptick in the number of admissions and patients coming in with significant side effects from the COVID and infection. And so, you know, it's always a challenge. Our staff are doing what they always do, which is take excellent care of their patients. They're very committed to them and providing, you know, the best care that we can. But it is certainly, you know, a long haul here for them. And I think that there are people that are just hoping that we can get through these next couple of months without, you know, having too many calamities. You know, one of the pieces that we're concerned about is that as the hospital fills up with patients with coronavirus, our ability to take care of all the other problems, traumas, cardiovascular diseases, cancers, elective and non-elective surgeries becomes very problematic. So this really impacts people both with COVID and without.
How are you doing personally with 8.5 months of this kind of stress?
Well, fortunately, I've been had a little vacation here for the Thanksgiving holiday, although I didn't go anywhere. Needless to say, I stayed in the backyard with my mom at 10 feet apart. But still, it's nice to have a little bit of a break. I'm sort of getting back into the swing of things. But, you know, it is, as an infectious disease doctor, it's a very interesting time, but it is certainly challenging. And, you know, we just really have an enormously important task to do in the next couple of months to try to get through this very, very difficult time.
Yesterday, we were speaking with healthcare professionals and how they were dealing with the stress of this. And we had a listener call in who said she had spent 8 months as a COVID nurse in an ICU locally, and she finally just couldn't take it anymore. She's now working on plastic surgery cases instead, and said the attrition rate was quite high with nurses in the COVID ward because the burnout is just so real for those day in and day out, and particularly at the height of this when so many people were dying in the ICU.
It is. It's very difficult. The nurses spend 12 hours with these patients. They often are the last person to be with them when they're dying. So the emotional stress, the nurses and the respiratory therapists, I think, have borne a lot of the burden of this pandemic. But, you know, all the staff, the EVS workers, the physicians, the, you know, all of the ancillary staff, the LVNs, it is tremendously fatiguing. And so we need to get through this and get done with this thing because it's just really taking its toll.
Chance for you to ask questions of Dr. Schreiner, infectious disease specialist at Huntington Hospital in Pasadena. Our number, 866-893-5722, 866-893-KPECC. You can tweet your question at AirTalk. You can post it on the AirTalk Facebook page or post on the AirTalk page at kpecc.org. A Centers for Disease Control panel is meeting today to discuss recommendations for prioritizing the distribution of the coming COVID-19 vaccines. Dr. Schreiner, your thoughts about, you know, who should be in the first group and which way you think the CDC panel is likely leaning?
Well, I think consensus on immunization practices, which is the ACIP, they're the governing body for most vaccine regulations and recommendations, and that's part of what the CDC is discussing with them is I think most of us feel that probably the healthcare workers are going to be the first people to receive the vaccines. They are on the front lines, and they are an essential part of the community to keep communities functional. So that seems to be without too much controversy. After that, it probably is going to be those that are at highest risk for either a bad outcome or for actually spreading the disease. And so it probably would be elderly people, nursing home residents, at very, very high risk if they contract COVID. And then first responders and essential workers that have to go to work, bus drivers, taxi drivers, those kind of people. And then moving down through the population, teachers, and then eventually the rest of the population of the country. But it's going to be a Herculean task. And, you know, I think the good news is it looks like the vaccines are very effective and very safe, and we certainly encourage people to get them. The difficulty is it's a two-part vaccine. Most of the vaccines require two injections. The Johnson & Johnson is the only single one. We have different platforms to choose from, just getting it distributed is going to be difficult. That's why hospitals will probably be the first test, because they have the freezers that are required for the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines that have to be kept at very cold temperatures.
It looks like the first round of those vaccines, provided the approval comes next week from the Food and Drug Administration, could be in just a couple weeks here. There could be the first rollouts coming fast.
Yeah, that's right, Larry. You know, actually, today is a World AIDS Day. We sort of have forgotten about that pandemic, which is still very much ongoing with 37 million people in the world still infected with HIV. But we don't have a vaccine for that viral disease. And so to create a vaccine for this, a brand new pathogen that we've never seen before, never experienced before, within this time frame is a remarkable achievement. And kudos to the scientists and the companies that frankly put this together, because the vaccines do appear to be safe. And I think we'll sort of be our way out of this. But we've got to get through the next 2 months to get there. And that's going to be the critical period.
You mentioned employees in nursing homes as well as patients in those. And it seemed to me that they should be in the first group, because 40% or so of the fatalities from the coronavirus are in those nursing facilities. So it would seem to me, and certainly frontline medical workers generally, but it would seem with that highly vulnerable population, it's extremely important.
Well, we hope that, frankly, the caregivers, and you know, we're not just talking about doctors and nurses, we're talking about LVNs, we're talking about home health aides. Some people that have, you know, don't have lots of extensive medical training but are providing medical care for people in skilled nursing facilities and assisted livings, those folks should be included in the healthcare worker, you know, moniker, so that they can get the vaccine early. And again, a lot of this is going to be overlapping between, it's not like we're going to do this group and then we're going to do that group. As more and more vaccine becomes available, we probably can overlap and start widely vaccinating the populations. That's probably the way it's going to play out.
We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. There is still skepticism among some about the effectiveness and the safety of the vaccine. We see from an Ipsos study that's been conducted that France, interestingly enough, the birthplace of Louis Pasteur, of all people, found that only 54% of French adults would be willing to get a COVID-19 vaccine when it becomes available. The percentage is higher here in the U.S., but there still appears to be a significant amount of concern or skepticism. But, you know, Dr. Schreiner, you know, when you look at us as human beings, we are sort of pack animals. We follow the lead of people around us. And I wonder if more and more people get vaccinated, if that's going to radiate and lead to some of that concern abating rather quickly.
I hope so, Larry. The studies that have been done for both Moderna and Pfizer, those are huge trials. The Moderna was 33,000 people. Pfizer's 44,000 people. Those numbers are continuing to grow. So that's almost 100,000 people that received either a vaccine or placebo. And, you know, it's been about 4 to 5 months since those people were vaccinated. And there haven't been any deaths in those groups in the people that received the vaccines. There frankly haven't been significant side effects, you know, sore arm, fever, that kind of stuff, but nothing that has shown itself at this point. Now, could something happen 12 months from now? It's possible, but it's very unlikely, especially those particular vaccines or these mRNA vaccines. It's just a little smidgen of genetic material that's sort of been harvested and duplicated from the virus. And so they're very, very safe vaccines. And I, for one, certainly am happy to get vaccinated because the mortality with COVID is very high, and especially when you're my age. I'm 62. So, you know, I think that if I were given the choice between trying to ride it out, you know, and get regular natural immunity from getting infected or getting a vaccine, I'm all in for the vaccine. I think it's going to be our way out, and I hope that people understand this is a really important thing to do.
Sabrina asks on Twitter, where do people who are HIV positive and young stand in prioritization for a vaccine? Do you know, Dr. Schreiner?
Well, the good news is that all of the vaccines, with the exception of a couple that are in China, are killed vaccines. They're, none of them are live or live attenuated vaccines, which would be an exclusion for people with HIV. You know, HIV is does compromise your immune system, and even in well-controlled HIV disease, we still feel that there are some abnormalities of the immune system that may be problematic in the setting of another viral infection. Although, interestingly enough, COVID is not terribly common in HIV-infected people, so it's maybe they're very much more cautious or something. It's not clear to me why that is, but at any rate, these vaccines should be safe in them, and they should probably be prioritized, maybe moved a little bit to the front because they are immunocompromised.
Linda in Pasadena says, were any of the vaccine trials conducted with participants who are in nursing homes, you know, residents of nursing homes, or would that be too dangerous to do, Dr. Schreiner?
I don't believe that any of the participants were in nursing homes. There may have been some that were in assisted livings. I know that certainly with Pfizer, they did have people over 65. It's a little problematic doing those kind of studies in nursing homes, and these vaccines have not been studied well in children yet. So those are going to be two areas where we're going to have to watch things very carefully. But that being said, again, these vaccines appear to be very safe and quite effective. I mean, 95% for these two first ones, that's incredible. We were expecting 60 to 70%, but that's really an amazing percentage.
All right. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Dr. Schreiner, one of the things I've been hearing from listeners, and I've gotten several emails over this just recently, is the challenge in getting a COVID-19 test, that because of either the lines that are available or determining whether an insurance company is going to be covering the test, which sites they can make appointments at for the testing, that there's a lot of hurdles for people to go through. Why, as we're 8.5 months into this, is it so difficult to get a COVID test?
Well, I think this has really been where we've not performed as well as we could have. Testing has been the conundrum here for this pandemic, and it continues to be. And now the disease is so prevalent, and there's so many people who want to get tested, and frankly should be tested because lots of people get exposed. It's becoming difficult to do it. And again, there's sort of a supply and demand thing. Right now, we do seem to have enough testing capabilities, but you know, accessing them, having insurance pay for them, all the things that you cited are problematic. We're doing a better job at testing than we did certainly back in March because we have more available, but it still is not enough. And that is going to be something I think that we're going to need to increase, especially in the next 2 months, because there's just been so much disease that's been spreading through the community.
Alice in Sierra Madre, you're on Air Talk.
Hi, I have one question, one comment. The first question is, should people who have had COVID, diagnosed COVID, especially serious cases, get the vaccine? And the second thing is, I want to do an on-air thank you to Dr. Schreiner. My nephew contracted a very serious case of COVID 5 months ago. He's a paramedic, and he was in the hospital for 3 months, or excuse me, 3 weeks. And Dr. Schreiner, you just recently allowed him to get a CT scan at your medical clinic. This is a workers' comp case. There's a lot of red tape, and you really helped him. So thank you.
That's nice to hear. Alice, thank you so much. And how is he doing? Is your nephew, Is he recovering?
He is. It's 5 months, but he still gets winded very easily. There is no damage to his lungs, but he still has effects, Larry.
Okay, Alice, we're so sorry and hope that he continues to improve over time. Dr. Schreiner, so nice to hear about your helpfulness with her nephew. But good question about whether those who've had COVID should then get vaccinated once they recover.
Indeed, that's an excellent question, Alice. And I think that, you know, at this point, we're probably going to recommend that even if you've had COVID, that you go ahead and get vaccinated. We do think that natural infection might be more immunogenic and for perhaps longer lasting, but we don't know for sure. So I think probably that's where antibody testing might be helpful and perhaps some more sophisticated testing that's being developed and assessing T cell response. That if you still have good antibody levels, you know, 6 months out, that maybe you don't need the vaccine. But I think most of us feel probably vaccinating won't hurt you, and it may help boost your immunity should you encounter the disease again.
Speaking of those who have, you know, long-term symptoms and ongoing physical challenges from COVID-19, there is the syndrome POTS, which stands for Postural Orthostatic Tachycardia Syndrome, which existed before COVID-19 and has a number of symptoms associated with it. What's your sense, Dr. Schreiner, of how often this syndrome is attached to serious cases of COVID?
Yeah, well, it does certainly seem to occur perhaps more frequently in people who've had severe disease, but it probably can occur even in people who have had mild to moderate disease. And one of the things that we notice with this is that this virus certainly likes to affect the immune system, and then it also affects the autonomic nervous system, which is what POTS is about. That's controlling heart rate and blood pressure and so forth. And that's a fairly, when POTS occurs, it often occurs after an infectious disease, whether it's COVID or not. So there probably is something to that. There may be many different forms of the sort of long haul or post-COVID syndrome, including things like neurologic abnormalities that may or may not be related to a POTS-type syndrome. But we're just beginning to learn about it and study it. And I think it's a fascinating but disturbing thing because it's preventing a lot of people from returning to work. And so that may have, you know, future impact certainly on their families and the economic situation as well. But it's a very interesting but concerning development with this virus.
Peter in Pasadena wonders, beyond the number of people in the trials, the composition of the people in the trials, are they from all over the world? How do you account for different populations around the world? So how extensive is the participation in these studies?
Well, that's a good question, Peter, and that's always something we worry about. You know, people that volunteer for studies often are sort of a little bit different than the general public. They're often very interested in science and, you know, obviously very compassionate because they're willing to participate in a trial of either a drug or a vaccine. So they're already a little bit different. But that being said, both of these, certainly most of the phase 3 studies are making an effort to recruit a wide variety of people, gender-wise, ethnicity-wise, age-wise, to test the vaccine. Some of them are problematic. I mentioned the pediatric population. It's very hard to do studies in children for lots of ethical reasons, and the elderly, and especially infirm people that maybe can't make an informed decision. Again, we have to be very sensitive to how we proceed with research in those populations. So I think the drug companies have really made an effort to try to have as much diversity as possible. And, you know, right now we don't have access to all of that data, but it looks like they're certainly age-wise and ethnicity-wise, the two mRNA vaccines, Pfizer and Moderna, seem to have a pretty diverse group.
Later on the program, we're going to talk about whether teens should be able to get vaccinated without parental consent. Dr. Schreiner, do you know if it's contemplated that teenagers, those under 18, would be vaccinated at all?
Well, they certainly should be. I mean, we're very concerned that young adults, you know, sort of between the ages of 15 to 30 are super spreaders. I mean, we saw it in the college campuses. They're, you know, they don't get that sick sometimes with the disease, but they're very capable of spreading it. So that population definitely should be vaccinated. And that brings up the whole issue of parental consent and so forth. So there's a lot of tricky sort of ethical and humanitarian issues, if you will, with this whole thing. But I think it's going to be interesting as we move forward on what we'll do.
Dr. Schreiner, is always such a pleasure. Thank you very much for joining us again.
It's always my pleasure, Larry. Thank you.
Thank you. From Huntington Hospital in Pasadena, infectious disease specialist Dr. Kimberly Schreiner joining us on Air Talk. When we come back, we'll talk about a lawsuit that's been filed against the LA Unified School District, somewhat similar to a lawsuit filed up in the Bay Area against the state of California over the ongoing distance learning in public schools and how that's been such a problem for students trying to stay up in their classes. We'll come back to that in just 1 minute.